This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. After 67 years in prison, Rochelle McGee finally wins his release. Meanwhile, in Texas,
70% of Texas prisons have no AC. Prisoners are dying almost every single day. Heat exhaustion, heat stroke, heart attacks, passing out.
When should prison officials offer water and medical attention to incarcerated people suffering from heat-related conditions while working in prison fields under the blistering sun?
When the strike came, they found 7 black workers to come. So they're not good enough, right, to get pension and health benefits and a contract, but they're good enough to have those temporary jobs that keep, you know, to break our strike.
Unite HRE Local 2 co-president Ada Brasino says black youth are being used as scabs at the Laguna Cliff Marriott, an Orange County hotel owned by the University of California.
We've been trying to grieve while at the same time seeking justice for Shireen, calling for accountability for this war crime that was committed by Israel.
The niece of murdered Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh speaks out.
They have so much money, but are they really caring about the students' well-being?
The DeSantis administration in Florida wants to turn a small public university in Sarasota into a model conservative campus. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. The University of California has invested $4 billion in the Blackstone Group, which has over $1 trillion in assets. One of the properties it had bought with UC money is the Laguna Cliff Marriott Hotel, where workers are now striking. At the July 19th UC Regents meeting in San Francisco, union co-president Ada Brasino charged that the hotel is using black workers as scabs and refusing to hire them as regular staff.
Many of you know that Unite Here Local 11 has undertaken the biggest wave of hotel strikes in the region's history. We have seen a big outpour of support from the community and other unions, but bosses are bosses, right? And hoteliers have gone to great strengths to break our strikes. In response to the strikes by the workers at the Cliff Marriott, Laguna Cliff Marriott, and by the way, we've got the workers right here. The Fairfield El Segundo and the Aloft El Segundo Ambridge Hospitality has brought in workers from a third-party agency to break our strike. But the outrageous part of that, because we already know what they do, right? The outrageous part of it is that these hotels have employed very few black workers amongst the permanent staff. Despite our ongoing demands for years to bring black workers into the hotel industry, and we've been demanding diversity in our hotels, but yet when it comes to breaking the strikes, of course they found black workers to work. So it was okay for them not to give pension benefits and health care and a way for black workers to bring their families into good jobs, but they will have them scab, and we will not stand for that. Are you ready to fight with us? We believe it's the responsibility of the UC Regents to see that Ambridge does not do that any further. And so we ask them, we ask that you all ask them to stand strong with us. We need black workers in the hospitality industry. We need to settle our contract. And as you know, we stand strongly with UAW to make sure that the charges are dropped ASAP. And also with ASME fighting for a fair contract, $25 is what they should get and more.
I was going to ask you about the discrimination.
Yeah.
You said that there's been discrimination by the hotels refusing to hire black workers.
Yeah.
Has there been any lawsuits or complaints to EEOC about this?
Well, we have been for a long time trying to ensure that black workers get back into the hotel industry. And so we have negotiated specific language in our contracts to do that. And despite that, it's been very difficult to make sure that the hotels hire. And so the Laguna Cliff in particular did not have black workers, or maybe one black worker in a long period of time. And then when the strike came, they found seven black workers to come. So they're not good enough, right, to get pension and health benefits and a contract, but they're good enough to have those temporary jobs that keep, you know, to break our strike. And so we're pushing back and we're saying, you know, that they have to hire permanently the black workers that they used, you know, to break the strike.
They did that at the St. Francis in San Francisco. When St. Francis workers went on strike, they brought in black workers to same. Is this systemic racism?
It is. It is. It's horrible. And we've taken this on in the last 15 years to try to change that throughout our union. I'm very proud of our union trying to do that. And we're successful in a very small percentage or portion. And now it's time to continue to push the issue. We have a proposal in our contract to ensure that we maximize the hiring and that we put pressure on the companies or more robust language to help us hire black workers into the industry.
And the Board of Regents have on it the Governor Newsom, Lieutenant Governor Tony Thurmond are all on the Board of Regents. Have any of them spoken up about this blatant union busting and at your hotels? And also,
we've been in talk with the Lieutenant Governor's office and many other politicians.
Why the silence?
I'm sorry?
Why the silence? Why the silence?
You know, I think they have an opportunity to stand up to that. I believe the Lieutenant Governor has already signed letters and has been, you know, in contact with the regents.
What about Governor Newsom?
Where is he? We need to reach out to him still to make sure that he's helping us.
Does he know about it?
I'm not sure if he knows about it just yet. It's obviously been, we've been in a very difficult situation with striking 33 hotels, so we're slow in getting to folks one by one.
And they don't want to pay what they negotiated with the UAW members yet, $4 billion to the Blackstone Group. Where are the priorities of the University of California?
What are the priorities?
Of the University of California.
Yeah, I mean, it should be to stand with working families. You have to take care of your students and their families and make sure that the community is able to, you know, to be successful. And so I believe they've got a moral obligation to ensure that their investments and that their workers and that their students are well.
And Governor, at the Regents meeting today, they announced that Governor Newsom appointed an executive from Disney to the Regents. I mean, do you think there should be more labor people in the Regents?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why aren't there?
I don't know. I don't know. But I think that's a fight that we should have.
That was Unite HRE Local 2 co-president Ada Brasino. One of the biggest obstacles to a contract for SAG-AFTRA and the Writers Guild is Netflix, which is controlled by Reed Hastings. Hastings is also a big supporter of privatizing public schools. Striking workers rallied at the Netflix headquarters in Los Gatos, California on July 19th.
It's 2014, and we're out here trying to fight these AI and these corporate greed and these CEOs that want to replace us with the AI and computers. It's insane. Bob Iger, he needs to cut his paycheck, you know, and give us some of that money. It just makes no sense that they want to just pay us one time and replace us with AI. That should make anybody mad, you know. If our jobs could get replaced by AI, so could yours. We got to fight corporate greed right now. It's insane out here.
I'm just here to talk a little bit more on the performance aspect. I'm here to talk about the AI situation as far as protecting our background actors. There are so many incredible opportunities that come through the Bay Area, but they're far and few in between as far as like really having an opportunity for our background actors. This is something that holds down our union, that provides us a little bit of sustainability in between gigs. And people don't really understand how little the pay offer is. If you really think about it, a half day's pay, what is a half day's pay in our union?
background actually to be about $97, $97.
Imagine, okay, imagine that you show up to work, someone pays you for half a day, they download everything that it is that you do, and they say, you're off for the rest of your life. That's exactly what this union is trying to, or not this union, but what the studios are trying to do to us. And so that's why we're here, that's why we're fighting. We're in the middle of this like tech capital, and we wanna make sure that we have the numbers in order to be able to get what is fair for us, because we wanna make sure that this remains a sustainable and realistic career for the rest of us, not just for us, but we have future generation actors that are walking along with us. And thank you all so very much, and let's keep this fight going.
Just 2%. We're not asking for a lot here, but we're asking for more than one penny.
I was working on a project. They hired to do one day, and they loved my character, and it blew up, and I got 2 years out of it. Now today, we are concerned that that one day, I create a character that they love, and they pay me for one day, and then they use AI to shoot it for the rest of the 2 years. This is a real concern. And obviously we don't want that. We can't have that. How are we going to continue to make a living as actors, performers, musicians, everything, if that's the case? The other thing that happens is control over your own image. There was a case with a film I was on where they wanted performers to be in a sex scene. And they said, I can't do that. I do not consent to do that. They said, well, we'll get your body double to do that for you. Wait. It still is going to look like I am doing the sex scene. And I can't have that. One of the actors was from a conservative country, portraying a girl next door kind of feeling. She couldn't be in a sex scene. The concern here with AI is that you can be put in a sex scene or whatever scene without even knowing, without your consent. This is real concerns, things they can do. They can capture your image and make it up for you without you even knowing, without you consulting, without you knowing. Look, I don't think that, I can't imagine that happening. But it is a real concern, and it could happen. And that's why we're here today.
I am out here because I am a human and not AI. I'm out here fighting for our rights like the rest of my brothers and sisters on this line. This is an important thing for us. I mean, this is our future. So, yeah. So they just want workers. They don't care what they're doing to the people that are working there. That hits Walmart. That's just, unfortunately, the time and age that we live in now, that everybody is out for their own, and they're not really realizing what it's doing to the smaller people. We are the ones that branch the entertainment.
Those were the voices of striking SAG-AFTRA members at Netflix's Los Gatos World Headquarters. That was Freddie Hubbard's Backlash. Legal developments for death row prisoners in Texas include executions scheduled, new meal procedures, a protest against the cruel treatment of incarcerated people during the deadly Texas heat wave, and the upcoming prison board meeting in Galveston. Gloria Ruback of the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement and KPFT Houston's Prison Show reports.
Right now, there are 7 women and 177 men on death row in Texas. 4 of them have execution dates already set. 5 have been legally lynched by Texas this year. But before I continue about Texas death row, I need to say that due to the brutal heat now being experienced in Texas, it could be that of the 118,000 people now incarcerated in Texas, 83,000 may actually be facing a death sentence. And why is that? Because 83,000 prisoners live in brick or concrete or steel buildings with no air conditioning. 70% of Texas prisons have no AC. Prisoners are dying almost every single day. Heat exhaustion, heat stroke, heart attacks, passing out. These are occurring every minute that you are actually listening to me talking. One prisoner's spouse put on Facebook, "I'm so sick of this damn prison. My husband had a seizure because of the heat and his insulin being low. The officers did effing nothing. This is the second time this has happened to him, having seizures. It is too damn hot." Another woman wrote, "I don't know what else to do anymore. My husband said they still ain't passing out water. He's been asking to go to medical and they're ignoring him. He finally passed out, busted his head open on the concrete floor. His cellie has been cleaning up the blood and tending to the wound on his head." His cellie, not a doctor or a nurse. Families are having to use GoFundMe to raise money to bury loved ones. One woman put on her GoFundMe page, "My name is Christy Williams. On June 23rd, our family got a phone call that my brother, TJ, had passed away. He was made to work outside in a field in Huntsville with little to no water, and there was a state of emergency heat advisory in place. He had told them the day before he was so exhausted and so thirsty and he needed water. But the next morning, they still made him go back out. He collapsed and died. They couldn't resuscitate him." This is going on all the time. This has to stop. Totally ignored them, and they never even had a hearing. So that's it on the heat. The Texas legislature just wound up their session. There were four bills that the Texas House passed and sent to the Senate regarding AC. The Texas Senate did nothing. None of those bills even got a hearing, much less made it to the floor. So that was it. And they don't meet again until 2025. And the heat is only going to get worse. Let me say that. We know that global warming is real. You can go to prison if you lock your kids in a car, if you put your animals in a car. Why isn't it a crime to let people who are incarcerated where they can't get water or ice or showers? This should be a crime. The Texas death penalty abolition movement charges Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and the Texas Senate with murder, period. We will be going to the prison board meeting in August. The board needs to take responsibility because they're over the whole prison system. And we will be demanding that they put AC in. The legislature has millions or billions in excess funds. They're all going to be guilty of murder if they don't put AC in. On Tuesday, July 18th, about a dozen organizations held an incredible event in the state capitol building and outside. They had a press conference that was filled with reporters. In fact, there was standing room only, and people were out in the hall trying to push their way in. Families and organizers both spoke about the deaths that were going on in the prison. After the press conference, people delivered stacks of letters they had received from prisoners to different legislators' offices. A rally was held out on the south steps of the Capitol, where families spoke again about what had happened to their loved ones. They also assembled a 6-foot by 10-foot cell and challenged people to go inside. And this was enclosed. I mean, it had walls and a ceiling and everything. They were enclosing people in there for 7 minutes so they could see what the heat felt like. And the cell was sitting out in the Texas heat. People had booze, there was petitions and so on. This got news coverage from the New York Times to the Los Angeles Times to National Public Radio, as well as every news outlet around the state of Texas. Every major Texas newspaper has actually editorialized against prisoners dying and asking for air conditioning. Next, I want to talk about those people who have been legally killed by the state of Texas, not in a hot cell, but through an IV in their arm. There's been five people executed or legally lynched. In January, it was Robert Frada, In February, a Latino man, Wesley Ruiz, was executed. Also in February, John Ballantine, an African-American man, was executed. In March, two Black men were executed, Gary Green and my friend Arthur Brown, who was innocent. There have been three stays issued this year, which was good. We'll see how long they last. Anibal Canales, Andre Thomas, and Ivan Cantu got stays. But starting on October 10th, which is World Day Against the Death Penalty, Texas will be executing Jedediah Murphy, a Jewish prisoner who people should Google Jedediah Murphy, who grew up in the most unconscionable conditions. And then in November 9th is Brent Brewer. November 16th, a Native American man by the name of David Renteria will be executed. And in November 25th, around Thanksgiving, a man named Will Spears is set for execution. So those are the legal lynchings that are going on. Now I want to just give some information briefly about sending mail to Texas prisoners. I was so hoping that this would never happen because I know from writing Mumia Abu-Jamal, Pennsylvania does this, but Texas is going to do it now. And that is, mail is going to be sent to an outside source and copied and sent to the prisoners' tablets. So if somebody's kids or grandkids get their crayons out and make a cute little picture, they'll never get to touch it. It'll show up on their tablet, hopefully in color, but it depends how much memory they're going to have on their tablets. So I'm going to give the address of how this mail now has to be addressed. The first line needs to say Texas Department of Criminal Justice, which is an oxymoron. Then the second line, you put the incarcerated person's full first name and last name and their prison number. The next line is Post Office Box 660400, Box 660400. And the last line is Dallas, Texas, 75266. 75266. Apparently, magazine subscriptions and books that you send in from Amazon or a publisher or whatever, those will still go to them in the mail. But letters and so on will, they'll just get to see a copy. The one, somebody asked about this, I guess the one nice thing is if you send a self-addressed stamped envelopes, they will return your mail to you. And then if somebody gets out, maybe they will eventually see it. But that's, and you know what? This is being done to keep drugs out. And hello, drugs are not coming in through the mail. They're coming in through the guards. The guards don't get paid enough to begin with. So they sell everything from drugs to cell phones to who knows what. But this latest repressive act is supposedly to keep the prisons drug free. Another really insane thing that is happening. Houston, Texas is located in Harris County. About 100 cases of criminal appeals have just been discovered by the county's so-called justice system that have been overlooked for two decades. Two of these are death row appeals, Tony Tyrone Dixon and Saeed Robani. Tony Dixon is a prisoner with an extremely low IQ. He was sentenced when he was 17. He was a juvenile. His first appeal was filed in 1998. 16 years later, this appeal is all of a sudden surfacing. During this 16 years, the Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional for people who were under 18 to be sentenced to death. He did get off death row in 2005 after this Supreme Court ruling, but he's sitting there with no appeals. Insane. The other prisoner, Saeed Robani, and I want to say I talked to a friend on death row who told me when he met Tony Dixon, when he got to death row back in the 90s, Tony could not read or write. He said, I was trying to help him learn his ABCs and learn to read, but it was kind of a lost cause. And the other death row case that was lost by Harris County was a man named Saeed Robani, who is extremely mentally ill. I have known about his case for decades and decades because he has mostly been at the psych unit. My friend on death row said he's only seen him a couple of times actually on death row. He was sentenced to death in 1988. During this 30 years that he should have been having appeals, you know, he was off in La La Land at a psych unit. So in May of this year, when these cases were found, the prosecutors agreed that he should get a new sentencing hearing. And hopefully he will actually not be sentenced, but put into a mental hospital where he definitely needs mental health care. I'll end on a positive note. There was a woman sentenced to death in the 80s by the name of Pam Perillo. That was a Houston case. And after she had been on death row about 20 years, she got her conviction overturned. And turns out her attorney was sleeping with the main witness against her. So she was sentenced to prison terms. Well, she got out of prison finally. She faced execution in 1996. I believe it was 1999 or 2000 when she finally got her sentence overturned. And she got out of prison in 2019. She's recently moved to the Houston area. She's married her longtime love, Connie Woodard. So we're going to be celebrating Pam's life, her story, at our September Abolition Movement meeting. And we will also be having the mom of Erica Shepherd, who is currently on death row, even though she didn't kill anybody. But Erica's mom lives in Houston. And Pam and Erica's mom, Madeline, have been in touch all these years. That's going to be a nice celebration in mid-September for the abolition movement. People can keep up with us on our Facebook page. It is The Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. You have to put the in front of our name. There's legal updates, stories about what the legislators are doing, and so on. And we'd love to have you get involved. We'd love to have you go to the prison board meeting with us on August 25th and get active. And we are going to stop these legal lynchings in Texas. This is Gloria Ruback reporting from Houston, Texas, with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. You can hear us on KPFT's Prison Show on Friday nights, the second Friday of every month between 9 and 10 o'clock. And it'll be streaming at kpft.org.
This segment was produced by Akua Holt. On June 27th, the state of Texas approved water price increases for incarcerated people. According to a Newsbreak report, the state raised the price from $4.80 per case, that's 24 bottles, to $7.20 per case.
I remember when I first came in prison, man, boss wouldn't let me cut no wood. He asked me, you ever cut no wood? I said, I've never cut no wood in my life. He said, you put that axe down. Said, it cuts wood here. I said, you stand right there and I'll show you how they cut wood. He hollered over old Chime and said, old Chime, what's he saying, son? He be singing the lead on the Let the Hammer Ring, a variety of verses. And everybody be in chords with him, Let the Hammer Ring, and all acts would be dropping. And when the timber's on the ground, there'd be 300 axes dropping with him.
Those were Texas Prison Work Songs. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. The Israeli police assassination of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was the focus of a recent forum on laborfest.net. Shireen's niece, Lina Abu Akleh, spoke.
I appreciate that even after a little over a year now, after my dear aunt was killed, that she's still being remembered, she's still being honored. And we have these communities, these organizations that continue to shed light on what happened to Shireen, but also to remember her and remember what she stood for. Millions around the world, they knew Shireen as the voice of Palestine. She was the voice of truth, voice of justice. She was a proud Palestinian-American journalist for Al Jazeera. She spent her entire life reporting on injustices Palestinians face, as well as their dreams, accomplishments, and the beauty of Palestine. For her, it wasn't just injustices. She always wanted to uplift Palestinians, uplift their stories, and show the world a different side of Palestine, but at the same time, make sure that their message is heard around the world. Shireen spent her entire life, she dedicated her entire life for the cause of Palestine, because not only was she was doing this because, as she said, she wanted to be close to the people. And this was her way of getting their voices heard across the world. And ever since May 11, our entire lives have changed. We woke up to the news that Shireen was killed by an Israeli soldier while she was on duty at the Jenin refugee camp. She was wearing her press vest. She was wearing a helmet. She was fully identified as a journalist. And yet she was targeted, her alongside her colleagues. She was shot at around 16 times. And the one bullet that shot her changed our entire lives forever. Ever since then, there was a life before Shireen, and then there was a life after Shireen. What she left behind is something that I don't think will ever be forgotten. She was a legend. She will always be a legend, and legends are not forgotten. Shireen was professional at what she did. She knew how to get close to the people. She was always there for the people, and she wasn't just there to cover the news, but she was also there to be close to the people. And this is something that continues to be remembered about her. She was empathetic, compassionate, and these are some of the characteristics that I learned from her. We have been trying to grieve. We've been trying to grieve while at the same time seeking justice for Shireen, calling for accountability for this war crime that was committed by Israel.
That was Lena Abu Akleh, niece of murdered Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, speaking at a recent forum at laborfest.net. She was joined by Palestinian journalist Saeed Arakat, Washington bureau chief for the Palestinian-based Jerusalem newspaper Al-Quds.
Reporting on the Palestinian issue has always been a very frustrating thing. I've done it for decades, and it has never gotten easy, or it has never gotten, you know, the kind of scrutiny that it should. You know, I mean, it is first of all, I mean, just to mention, there has been since 1967, the Israelis not only killed one or two Palestinians, 54 Palestinian journalists have been killed. So it's a huge number. You know, that nobody talks about. As we speak today, there are 16 Palestinian journalists in prison, in Israeli prisons, for reporting on what goes on in Jenin and the other camps and so on. I mean, last week we saw very blatantly, I mean, very clearly, very graphically, how Israeli occupation soldiers treat Palestinian journalists. I mean, they beat up journalist from Palestine TV, for instance, you know, in front of everybody. They don't care, you know, because they know that this will not really garner the kind of attention that it ought to in the West. And I tell you, I mean, you know, we talk about Shireen Abu Akleh. It is really a very poignant moment in the history that illustrates the history of Palestinian journalism and so on. Anybody that tells you that it was not intended, the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, is lying. It was intended. They went in. I know exactly how these sniper teams work. I was, when I was with the UN for my hiatus from journalism for 5 years, I was the UN spokesman in Iraq. And I know, you know, fully how the sniper teams work. They go in, they go by twos, one a spotter, you know, they sit with their, you know, American supplied infrared binoculars and so on. They know every movement and so on. And they shoot one shot, you know, I'm sorry to be graphic, but that's exactly what happened. They shoot one shot to see how it goes, what is the wind direction, all that. I mean, it's a precise science. So in this case, when Shireen, you know, on May 11, and this story really ought to be told over and over again, when they went in, they shot, I mean, they passed by the contingent, by the Israeli soldiers' contingent, and they told them, we're going to that, you know. So they knew exactly where they were going. And then the spotter, you know, said, that's the way they are. And they shot my colleague first, Ali Smoudi, from my newspaper. And they shot him in his shoulder. And this was the eighth time, by the way, that he gets injured. So he still is reporting. He was reporting last week from Jenin. So they shot him in the shoulder because he was the person next to Shireen. And he also, as most Palestinian journalists, they earn a living by doing so many things. He was also producing for Al Jazeera that day, other than reporting from, you know, for my newspaper, Al Quds Daily newspaper. So they shot him. They knew exactly where the next shot is going to land, and they shot her right through. They know exactly what spot they're going to shoot. So all this was planned and pre-planned. And approved, and so it was intentional. And the reason I say this is just to show the hypocrisy of the U.S. government, that on July 4th, 22, last year, July 4th, 22, Independence Day, because they knew that nobody's going to read things on Independence Day anyway, it's a holiday, they issued a statement saying, more than likely, and that's exactly what it says, more than likely it was done by an Israeli soldier, but there was no intentionality. There was no intentionality, you know, and that's it. That was it. You know, all the other meetings that happened afterwards were just nonsense. They were just a crock. You know, it was malarkey, as Biden likes to say.
That was Al-Quds D.C. Bureau Chief Saeed Arakat.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
That was We Will Not Go Down, Song for Gaza Palestine by Michael Hart. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. On Friday, NAAC President and CEO Derek Johnson joined Vice President Kamala Harris in Jacksonville, Florida, to discuss the Florida Board of Education's new standards teaching about slavery in the U.S. Johnson later issued a statement that the new standards convey a sanitized and dishonest account, quote, suggesting that enslaved people develop skills that could be applied for their personal benefit, unquote. Johnson also said, quote, those hate-inspired policies are a cancer that, if not stopped, will spread throughout the nation, destroying hard-won victories and setting us back decades, if not centuries, unquote. Here's Professor Michael Eric Dyson's reaction.
It's quite ludicrous. It's devastatingly deceitful. It's mendacious, and it doesn't recognize the central place of pedagogy and teaching and curriculum in trying to get at lessons for young people. Why is the state trying to impose its hand on the teaching of history of African-American people for the state's students? This is something that should be generated with educators, experts at disseminating information. This would be akin to saying that Native American people, when we teach their history, we should not only talk about the smallpox blankets that were distributed by the Pilgrims, but the attempt of Native Americans to defend themselves that was equally violent. This would be like teaching the Holocaust, saying that there were some good things that Jewish brothers and sisters picked up in those death camps that, should they survive, would be helpful for them to make their way in life. This is ludicrous. This was an institution of enslavement. Now they're saying we should teach both Rosa Parks and Thomas Jefferson. No problem there, except to say that Thomas Jefferson, while being a creative interpreter of American history and a contributor as a founding father, was also enslaving human beings. Rosa Parks was not. So this false equivalency between experiences of African-American people and others being dictated to by the state of Florida is a grave disservice to true education in America. And those who are on the right wing who supposedly want to keep government out of the classroom and the bedroom are doing the exact opposite. What impact will it have? It will deny young students access to rigorous history, to robust history, to an accounting of America for what it has done in the past that has been glorious and has been grievous. The point of history is for us to learn from that past in order to apply lessons to the present. What Florida wants to do is to distort what happened back then so they can manipulate what's going on now. The two are intimately webbed, and I think tragically so in the case of Florida.
That was Dr. Michael Eric Dyson responding to Florida's new standard for teaching the U.S. history of slavery on MSNBC.
Fish are jumping.
and the cotton is high.
That was Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong's version of Summertime. The DeSantis administration in Florida wants to turn a small university, Sarasota, into a model conservative campus. Sophia Brown of WSLR, Sarasota, Florida, has the report.
Richard Corcoran, the interim president of New College, who is in charge of a conservative makeover, wants to beautify the campus for incoming students. One of his first measures was to have student-made mural art painted over. Students and the art community are aghast. Sophia Brown has the details.
It goes without saying that Sarasota has a vibrant art scene. A quick drive through downtown will give you a tour of multiple art studios, sculptures nestled in roundabouts, and striking murals on almost every street corner. And, while it's no Ringling, the New College of Florida has its own modest art scene. Just this winter, a series of student murals cropped up at the campus's fine arts complex, the Iserman Gallery on Caples campus. However, interim president Richard Corcoran has announced plans to beautify the campus this summer to achieve a, quote, pristine look, which has included painting over these student murals without prior notice. While these beautification efforts were first announced on July 1st, no further information about what these efforts are has been released. New College's communications and marketing department did not respond to requests for information by deadline. The college's own Landscape and Signage Task Force Committee, the group that would typically vet these kinds of renovations, has also been kept in the dark. One community member close to the discussion, who wished to remain unnamed, said that the New College Board of Trustees has given Corcoran, quote, a lot of latitude to do what he wants, and that he's very interested in the college looking fantastic. It's just that there may not be a lot of agreement about what fantastic looks like, and there may not be a lot of thinking about the implications of different decisions, end quote. Five murals were painted over, including one by Danielle Digert, a New College alum and member of the local art collective, SRTQ. Her mural at the Iserman Gallery was painted in 2016. The four other murals were designed and painted by four current students, students like Annie Dong, who is studying art and psychology.
Yeah, I specialize as an artist into public work, so I have done murals. I have done a couple of murals on campus at New College, and one of them is, you know, the Hamilton mural, and then the other one is the mural done at Caples. I have done murals in St. Pete. I have done murals around Sarasota.
Annie explained that she found out the murals had been removed when she received a frantic text from the professor who had overseen the project. The professor had been driving by the Iserman Gallery only to see that the murals had disappeared. Annie says that neither her professor nor any student muralists were warned ahead of time or given any justification since then. All four of these recent murals were created during the fall semester for the on-site mural painting course taught by Professor of Art Kim Anderson. The murals were all brought before the Landscape and Signage Task Force Committee in October for approval. These murals each drew upon individual students' personal histories and experiences with the campus community, with themes ranging from the Florida environment and wildlife, to celebrating personal cultural heritage, to embracing diversity. The mural of one student, Hannah Barker, combined elements and imagery of Florida with Nepal, where she was adopted from. Han Nguyen's mural was inspired by the mythology of sirens and the ways that LGBTQ+ students might relate to these stories about alienation and otherworldliness. Emma Curtis's mural was a tribute to Sandhill Cranes and themes of community and migration that often characterize the college experience. Annie's own mural focused on red-crowned cranes and their symbolism in Chinese culture.
The reason why I produce a Chinese, like, base-inspired mural is because New College especially has a Chinese department that teaches about the literature, the culture, and that meant something big to me because I didn't have that growing up.
One possible explanation as to why these murals would be painted over is if there were cracks in the walls or the stucco needed to be repaired. Except, Annie says that the walls these murals were painted on had been repaired in advance to avoid this exact scenario.
Before we even did anything, before this class was ever, like, produced, we had to get it approved by, obviously, like, the higher-ups and the landscape department. After they got it approved, we select our walls. Once we select our walls, we proposed our design, and we had to go through a landscape committee, and then we got it approved by votes. And once we select the walls and we got approved by the landscape committee, they sent people in the next couple of weeks to power wash the walls, fix up cracks, whatever issue that the wall had. That way it can be clean and it can be ready for the student to paint over it.
Additionally, $2,000 had been raised by the Alumni Association for scaffolding to create these murals. In light of these developments, there's one other mural on campus that people are now keeping a closer eye on, a mural and memorial commemorating Nan Freeman, a former student and activist of the United Farm Workers Movement, who was killed in 1972 during a protest when she was hit by a truck. The mural was painted by Danielle Dygert last year, the alumna and artist who has already had one of her murals at the Iserman Gallery erased. The Nan Freeman mural is located in the breezeway on the first floor of the Academic Center, otherwise known as the ACE Building. Nan's story is well known at New College, and many of her classmates, friends, and family are still active members of the campus community, like Julie Morris, a former Associate Vice President of Academic Affairs. Julie and several others have been increasingly concerned the Nan Freeman mural would be the next one to go. Julie says that she received confirmation from the Assistant Director of Facilities Planning and Construction that the mural will not be painted over, but that she has not heard the same from Interim President Corcoran. Given the sudden and sporadic nature of these beautification efforts so far, they will be keeping an eye out. A few other beautification efforts have also gone underway, like replacing all of the grass in front of the campus's library and the ACE building with AstroTurf. While AstroTurf is low maintenance and uniform looking, plastic lawns often overheat and give off odors in what's called off-gassing. And then there are the renovations of the Dort and Goldstein dorms this summer, which Corcoran announced during the July 6 Board of Trustees meeting. Typically regarded as upperclassmen dorms, new floors, ceilings, furniture, and appliances are being added. Why? Because these dormitories are being reserved specifically for incoming student athletes and transfer students. Returning students who have already been assigned to the rooms in these buildings earlier in the summer are now being relocated to other unrenovated dormitories. Annie says that these beautification efforts defy the meaning of the word, especially in the case of the murals.
They approach this beautification of the campus art. They're just erasing art. They're just wanting to patch up, making it look modern, making it look plain. But what they don't understand is that these students spent over 200 hours literally painting in the hot heat doing this. So it's like one of those things that it's like that doesn't define beautification.
Annie also spoke about the many campus renovations that she feels could better benefit students, but that are not being considered by this new administration.
What sucks is that they have so much money, but are they really caring about the students' well-being? We live in these dorms that have mold issues. What's going on there? Like, what? You have so much money. You're not fixing mold issues. You're not fixing any, like, we have students on campus that don't have access to food. Like, what are you doing there? I moved off campus because of this whole entire issue. Because I was so stressed seeing so many people and knowing this is happening. Now my friends are getting infected. Now we have people leaving.
The future of student art and beautification initiatives under this new leadership is uncertain, but Annie doesn't want this to be the end of New College students' public art initiatives in the community at large. To see more of her art, you can go to anniedartist.wixsite.com/anniedartist.
That was Sophia Brown of WSLR Pacifica in Sarasota, Florida. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter @PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.